Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
In the next few days, I'm sure, we learned a little bit about it last week, is that it seems as though, as a shock to, I would expect, nobody, costs for things like the LRT have spiked all of a sudden. It appears that building projects like this have now gone up by as much as 30% more, according to provincial documents. I want to bring in John Best. He is the publisher of the Bay Observer. Joins us now. John, how are you this morning? This evening? It's not this morning. The eclipse apparently burned not my retina, as my brain. How are you this evening, John?
Just great. Yeah, we've all lost a day.
So I cannot believe there is a human being alive, certainly no one who has followed the endless LRT saga in the city of Hamilton, who could be 1% shocked to find that provincial documents are now saying costs have gone up from our last expected number. Is there a person out there who thought this was not the case?
I don't think so, Scott. And frankly, I'm skeptical of the 30%. I would expect, based on what we've seen with the Eglinton Crosstown, some of these other projects, I think it'd be a pleasant surprise if it was only 30% over budget. So, you know, I don't know. That comes from an FOI request that the Hamilton Spectator did. And I don't know what year those estimates were based on, where the government was expressing concerns about cost overruns on all of its transit projects. But you know, there's $3.4 billion in 2021 dollars has been assigned to that project, and I just can't imagine that it's going to be built for anything close to that now.
Well,
and the other problem, sorry.
No.
The other issue is finding somebody who will take on the project. It's not like we have unlimited capacity in the construction industry to take on. There's only three or four companies that really do this. And whenever we think, well, maybe the same three are getting all the work, maybe we should try somebody new, then you end up with a situation like we did with the stadium in Hamilton, where you get an organization from France building it, and they don't know anything about Canadian winters, and we lose almost an extra season. So it's money. It's who can build it. What's in the pipe already? Those are all issues.
And let's go to that last point you just made. There's a lot to get to, but let's start with that last point you made about you get someone who doesn't know what they're going to do, or doesn't know what they're doing. We've seen in Toronto with the Eglinton line, it is hopelessly behind and all kinds of problems that nobody had anticipated. We've seen in Ottawa, their LRT line has had endless problems with it, and sinkholes and things that don't work and tires or wheels that aren't round. I mean, it's the most insanely ridiculous stuff. At this point, surely you have to be able to go out and find a company that you can be absolutely confident is going to know what they're doing.
Yeah, and there's a lot of big projects ahead of us in the queue. The point I was making in the story I ran is this project is almost nowhere to be seen. It was mentioned in the budget. It was dead last on a list of transit projects that were listed in the budget. And under the line of what progress they're making, they're talking about meeting with First Nations groups. And it sounded like they were saying getting ready to explore underground infrastructure. That is so far away from anything that would look like a start that I was actually surprised to see that, because they'd already done some underground infrastructure movement 3 or 4 years ago before the pandemic. It just feels like there's something wrong there, Scott, in terms of where we fit in. And then you go to Infrastructure Ontario. They're the people that will actually put out the tenders and award the contracts. They have a list of 34 projects, and we're not listed at all. We're not on the sheet.
John, in Matthew's story, though, one of the really interesting things, and before the break, I gave a very confusing thing about how the numbers are not the numbers and we should be concerned about the numbers. Here's what I was talking about. The current estimate for Hamilton's LRT, which last we heard in 2021 was $3.4 billion, was redacted in the document for a variety of reasons, but we don't really even know, even in this document, there is a number. They know what the number is, but they've even blotted out what the number is that we would be paying for this. I know they can come up with all kinds of other reasons for cabinet privilege and all the rest, but anytime they start redacting stuff, I get concerned.
Well, not only that, it's right now it's being understood to be a 50-50 deal between the province and the federal government. And right at the end of that story, you had our local minister, Philomena Tassi, saying the federal portion is contingent on a business plan being submitted for the Hamilton LRT. And she said that hasn't happened yet. So that's the first time I've heard that one. I think most people thought the federal piece was in. I remember getting in response to a question, I remember getting a message from the feds a couple of years ago saying, well, when the business plan is submitted, then the funding will be available. And I didn't think that there had been an issue about whether it was being submitted or not. That submission would come from the province of Ontario. So there's another wrinkle.
Would that come from the province or would it come from the city? Because we've had no ability through the city, and I know they have to work with the province and unions, but the city, some people have tried for years now to find out what it's going to cost to even operate this. And we keep hearing, well, we can't know what it's going to cost to operate until we get the thing knowing what's going to happen with it. But now, based on what you're saying, if we can't find out what it's going to cost to operate until we get it built, but we can't get it built till we know what it's going to operate, that's an endless dog chasing its tail scenario.
Yeah, no, the business plan that she was looking for would be coming from the province, because the only skin in the game Hamilton is going to have, and it could end up being substantial, is operating and maintenance. This is a federal-provincial project for all intents and purposes. We're simply the place where it's going to be located. So that's what she's looking for, and I think that's where we also need to wonder what's going on. Why hasn't that been submitted? Why does the item not appear on Infrastructure Ontario's list of 34 major infrastructure projects? The way Infrastructure Ontario works, they're not the decider when it comes to big infrastructure projects. They get their marching orders from the government, and they clearly haven't received anything that's very definite at this point, because we're not seeing it on the project list.
Do you think that Hamilton should be concerned? And the reason I say it that way, we may have probably been concerned a lot, but if Pierre Poilievre wins and every poll says that he's going to win in a year and a half, you got to think that he and his government that is staring at a massive deficit, Justin Trudeau has been going around even in the last week giving out $20 billion in projects and things. You got to believe that Pierre Poilievre is going to be looking for things to trim, not to add. If this thing is not being built by a year and a half from now, do you think we should be concerned that that may be on the chopping block, the federal part of it?
Well, forget about that. I think we should be concerned about what Minister Tassi told the Spectator, that even with this government supposedly supporting the project, they haven't seen the paperwork. I think, to be honest, I've written about this. I think Hamilton should really start thinking about a plan B, where we try to salvage as much of that infrastructure money that we've been pledged. We have so many infrastructure problems right now. I just can't imagine we're going to go ahead and do this. We're building high-rise buildings in ghetto-like streetscapes right now, and we just have so much that we need to do. We've got a tremendous wastewater deficit. They did an asset management plan for the HSR. They figure they're going to be falling behind by $16 million a year on replacing buses and keeping things up to scratch. I think the real play here would be to, let's see how much of that money we can divert to our real infrastructure needs. I don't expect that to happen, by the way, but I think that's what the sensible thing to do.
There is one other thing that I have continued to wait to hear, and it has not happened yet, and it may never happen, John, but I've long thought that there is a possibility that as the price of this thing gets higher and higher and higher, there is going to be a point at which somebody in either the federal or more likely the provincial government is going to say, all right, we're still in for the amount we promised, but Hamilton, you're going to have to contribute something. I don't know if that's ever going to happen, but the mayor has already said just in this story, we're not doing that. And the previous mayor said we're not doing that. And previous council said we're not doing that. What happens if they say that?
Well, I think it's game over. I just can't see a way that in the financial, particularly with infrastructure and capital budgeting, I just can't imagine Hamilton being able to come up with enough money to make a difference. $200 million would be a huge burden for us. And with a project like LRT, that'd be a drop in the bucket.
One more on that one then. If the governments, if the provincial and federal governments both continue to up the ante and add, if it is only 30% more, but let's say it gets up to 4.5 or even 5 billion, do you think that even if we get that, does that come at a cost to Hamilton? Because again, a concern that I have is, all right, fine, we'll give you that money. But I got a feeling that if they do that, that any other request Hamilton is going to put in for anything else is going to get put right to the bottom of the pile. Here's your money. If that's where you want it to go, that's all you're getting. Don't come back for any more. That's my concern.
Yeah, I don't know if that would happen, but I think you have to look at the fact that we are getting, the way the program is assembled right now, where two senior governments are funding 100% of the capital cost. That's happening in Mississauga, but certainly Kitchener and Ottawa, they had to put up money.
Right.
It's very rare to see what is normally, transit is normally a three-way funding formula. And for some reason, we managed to get in with no funding. And I think it's fair to say that the premier's interests, he has interest in Hamilton, I'm sure, but his primary interest is Toronto and the area surrounding Toronto, where he's building rapid transit projects that link those communities and link into Toronto. We're a little further down the road west of all that. And I think that's one of the reasons why our project is either at the bottom of the priority list or, in the case of IO, it's not even on the sheet.
It's every time there's another story about this, it rarely is all good news. It's more and more troubling information that sounds more and more daunting. We'll see where this goes, but it does not sound, if you're a fan of the LRT, this has got to be causing you some considerable concern. John Best, always appreciate having you on. Thanks for doing this today.
My pleasure.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Well, it is Monday, which means it is time for Don Robertson, who was the owner and operator and GM and coach and multiple other things of the Dundas Real McCoys. He runs Comp Choice Realty. He is the Dundas 2024 Citizen of the Year. And he is a man who, as of right now, for the next few minutes, is enjoying all that Hamilton traffic has to offer. Sir, how are you?
Not happy.
Apparently, everybody who's coming home from the eclipse all got on the highway at once.
I think it extracted up. There must have been an alien come down and picked brains out of certain people. Normally a 20-minute drive. I've now been on the road for more than an hour. So, anyways.
Yes, I suspect others are in the same position, so I feel sorry for you. I appreciate those who are stuck on the road listening to us, but I thank you for doing that. And you know, Don, what this means that you're not getting to see right now is all the pregame festivities for the Blue Jays opening their redesigned Rogers Center, because you know they put $400 million into it this year. And I'm wondering what your level of excitement is about going to see this new stadium, or if, you know, a stadium is a stadium and don't really care. Which side are you falling on that?
Well, it was never a wonderfully designed stadium for baseball. So they're reappointing a lot of the seats to angle them, because football and other activities won't take place there anymore. But still, it's the seat slopes on the main level are very long. It gets you a long way from the game. You know, I remember going to Tiger Stadium, and you know, they were pretty steep, but it got everybody closer to the game. So they can never fix that. So based on what they're now going to charge for hot dogs and a pop and a beer and a bag of popcorn, it's probably going to take them a season and a half to get all their $400 million back.
Yeah, maybe even more than that. And I know you're being tongue-in-cheek, but it's like what I wonder about this is there is always, I think history would show, when a team, football, hockey, basketball, baseball, doesn't matter, when a team moves into a new home, arena or stadium or whatever, there is always a bump in attendance. There's always an increase. It's just people want to see the new place. I wonder if that same thing exists for a redone stadium. And it may. It may. I'm really interested to know whether people are eager to get to the same place that looks different or if it's just good enough to see it on TV once.
Well, there's two things. It better be that, because the start they've had isn't going to fill the stadium. I was in St. Petersburg for their opening game, and I have never, ever been in a poorer baseball park in my life than that ballpark in St. Petersburg. It is dreadful. It's just not a very good place to watch a baseball game, but I guess when you only get 15,000 people a night, it really doesn't matter where you play. So,
although it's a chicken and an egg, Don, isn't it? It's a chicken and egg. I've always thought that if they had a nice stadium in Tampa or St. Petersburg, that they would draw people. I think that a lot of the reason they don't go is because it looks like a mausoleum.
Well, it does. And, you know, they called it a sellout, but the one portion of the upper deck in the stadium didn't have a person in it. So their definition of selling all the seats is not fill every seat. I guess it's the only way they can have a sellout. There was a ton of Canadians there, as you might guess, you know, snowbirds. I was visiting snowbirds. There was a bunch of guys that we golfed with, and our wives went to the game. That was fun. But the stadium was terrible, although they did spank the Tampa Rays pretty well that night. But the stadium is dreadful. I can't fathom that there's a worse stadium in Major League Baseball. So, to your question, yeah, I think people will want to go to the Rogers Center. I understand tickets have been hiked suitably. I think they think they're the Toronto Maple Leafs. But we'll see if people will pay for a what looks like might be a non-contender.
Well, yeah, ultimately that's the point. I think what we've seen over the last couple of years is that Mark Shapiro, the president of the team, and Ross Atkins, Mark Shapiro in particular, looks like he's a guy who's really good at renovating stadiums and building practice facilities down in Dunedin. On those fronts, I think everyone gives him a tip of the cap and says, hey, they look fantastic. Good job. But as far as building a baseball team, early results. And Don, here's the thing. I don't even know if we can call this an early result, because this team is similar enough to last year's team and showing many of the same patterns already as last year's team. This feels like it's just an extension of last year's team. So it doesn't make it an early result then. This is just an ongoing thing. And those are not good, those results.
Well, he's been here almost 10 years, if not 10 years.
Not quite, because Anthopoulos left after the 2015, or was it 2016? So, they've been here for 7 or 8 years, at least, anyway.
Well, they've been here long enough to put their stamp on the team. And clearly, they put their stamp on the team. And that's what they built. You're right. They're good at maybe renovating and building new practice facilities, but they're not excelling at is finding decent players to play in those stadiums and practice facilities.
Yeah, and I do wonder, I mean, especially with tickets going up in price, I wonder if this team looks going into the year. Now, again, we got to say it's we're a week and a bit into the season, so we don't want to too heavily jump the gun here. But if this continues, if the way they're playing continues, I do wonder if once we hit August, September, if those seats are going to be filled. And that's you know, that's an indictment if you've got a new place and if it is not looking like it's going to be full.
Well, and you know, there was people squawking that Rogers weren't spending any money. I believe the Jays are the fifth highest salary spenders in Major League Baseball. So you would anticipate you would have better results. They have the resources.
We will see. It's there's one thing that I think is not going to work. You can have a winning team that will draw people. You can have a losing team that will draw people if it's really exciting and really likable. But I think the one thing you can't have is a losing team that's boring and draw people. And so far, this team looks, honestly, a week and a half in, it looks kind of boring. That can change, but that would be the one thing, I think, Don, that would be a real problem if they were boring and losing.
they didn't address and they didn't fix what was wrong. And that's on them. They knew what they needed. They identified their needs, but they didn't fill them.
Yeah. And they, you know, everyone will say, well, they went after Ohtani. Yeah, they sure did. And I understood the business case for Ohtani that you pay him $700 million US and you say, we can sell so many shirts and we can attract the Asian community from all over North America to be fans of this team and we can blah, 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 blah. There was a business case to be made for paying that kind of money to him. But the idea never was, I'm positive, the idea never was we have $700 million to spend and if we don't get him, we're spending it elsewhere. It was, there's nobody else who is like him who gives you that kind of business case. So, but it seems as though once Ohtani was no longer available, nobody wanted to come or they weren't going to spend on anybody to come because it just kind of became very blasé after that. And here we are. Here we are a week into the season. Honestly, we're about to have game number 8 and people are already dumping on this team as we are. And so far with good reason. We'll see. We'll see if that changes, but so far with good reason.
Yeah, well, they didn't have much of a plan B, did they? If they did, they didn't implement it very well.
It doesn't look like it. Don Robertson has survived the eclipse, survived the traffic. We'll see if he survives this show, but welcome to studio.
Thank you. It's fun to be here.
Yeah, as you said on the phone just before you got here, the traffic looking out the window is still all the way backed up the highway, up coming downbound. So
I was going home from the office 5 o'clock and Copetown took me forever to get onto Highway 52 and there were cars from Copetown to Wilson Street solid. And I've never seen anything like that before. I thought the 403 was closed and it wasn't. So I have no, did this eclipse, like I went to bed about 3:15 this afternoon because it was dark out. And when it's dark at my age, I go to bed. And I got up and I thought it was Tuesday. So maybe, and I'm kidding, but maybe a lot of people did that. I have no idea what's going on.
Don't know what happened. So we got a lot still to get to today. We're talking about the Jays, which they're just about to get started. The Leafs are playing tonight. But, you know, last week, had a piece in the paper that I think we've all seen coming for a while now, and that is that Michael Landlauer, the owner of the Bulldogs, saying he is not coming back to Hamilton, or at least doesn't see the Bulldogs coming back. He's committed to Brantford if they build an arena, which sounds likely. He's committed to being there long term. If Brantford doesn't build an arena,
Burlington might.
Burlington looks like they are about to build one on the lands right beside the GO station. We had Marianne Mead Ward, the mayor of Burlington, on here talking about that. It just doesn't seem like there is a path back to Hamilton for the Bulldogs. And if there's not a path for the Bulldogs, there's not for another OHL team because Andlauer holds the rights to this market. And AHL, I still think, is a tough one. I don't see how an AHL team, regardless. I got thinking about this. Has Hamilton, without knowing it, blown it here, not even for the hockey team, but just that you had a guy like Michael Andlauer in this market and Hamilton has chased him away?
I don't know how you'd frame it any other way. He's still feeding kids in Hamilton with his breakfast program. I don't see a lineup of people to replace him to do that. The guy has a heart the size of the city of Hamilton. And it's one thing, you know, to whether he was driven away or not, and whether there was, you know, no apparent option other than for him to have to relocate for a certain period of time. It's the way it was handled, like the lack of communications. I know you talk to him fairly frequently, and the communications.
Not lately. I mean, I talked to him for this story, but I mean, now that he's not here.
But leading up to it, yep. I mean, you know, you would often see comments, I haven't heard a thing. No one's contacted me. And for a guy that has done so much for the city, like Bob Young, can you imagine treating Bob Young like that too?
See, it's funny you mentioned that because it does seem to me that we have treated Bob Young and Michael Andlauer very differently. And I think they are both tremendous owners. I think Bob Young keeping the team here has been a great thing for the city of Hamilton. I mean, where would we be? Where would the Ticats be right now if Bob Young had not come along? So kudos to Bob Young. But it just seems odd to me that, again, we've treated him as well as we have. And the city has, especially city councilors and others, have fallen over themselves to treat Bob Young so well, appropriately so. Yep. And the opposite almost seems to be the case for Andlauer.
Yeah, I don't know the explanation for it. I'll find out because I'm going to ask, right? And it is particularly disappointing. On the other hand, a building that I've won some championships in, Brantford, he has put a lot of lipstick on that thing, and that community has rallied around them and proven that in this economy, they can be a successful OHL franchise. And they're going to be nothing but better next year. They, I think, finished much stronger in the standings than they expected to.
Mm-hmm.
And they're young, which may be why they didn't win in the first round, but they would have learned a lot. So I think next year they're going to have a wonderful hockey team. And he deserves all the success he can get. And they're talking about building a building, and I haven't heard once where Andlauer has to make any contribution to that new stadium.
Well, they have said that they need private partners. So that could be him or that could be someone else. They're not going to do it all themselves. So that is
okay.
That's an issue. But I mean, Brantford, unlike him, Brantford, I read this week, has 1,000 people on a season ticket waiting list to get in. And I was told that this blew me away. They played their last game when they were eliminated, but they played their game 6 of their series in Ottawa. And the mayor went to Ottawa to watch that game and support them in his Bulldog shirt.
Wow.
And if I am owning a team here and I have had none of that, and I go there, why in the world would I not want to stay there? And who would want to come here?
Well, here,
when you compare them, Don, we keep hearing that they're going to try and lure another team here. Who would want to come here when you look at how the owner of the team that was here got treated?
It's not a secret.
It's very public.
I think the only team that could find success here now would be the farm team in the American League for the Toronto Maple Leafs. I think that would be the sole viable option, and the Leafs run the Ricoh's Coca-Cola Center, and they have control of the Coca-Cola Center, so I can't see why they would leave, but, you know, I don't understand it. The other thing that I always found curious, and I don't have an answer for this either, when the escalator and a number of things were in need of repair at Cops Coliseum, And I understand it. It's tax dollars. So who's going to pay for all that? Andlauer paid for the ring. He paid to upgrade the scoreboard. And then he wanted to partner with Cadillac Fairview and build his own arena. And that couldn't happen. I mean, it wasn't going to cost the city a nickel to get a 5,000 or 6,000 seat arena.
No, it would have cost the city some. It would have cost the city some. But here's the question, I think, in retrospect now. You've now got Oakview Group coming in to do this $280 million renovation of First Ontario Center, which sounds terrific. It's going to be a concert first venue. They want to make it a concert venue. So that's terrific. But if that's going to be a concert venue first, is there not room in the city for a 5,000 seat sports venue somewhere?
Marianne Mead Ward is no fool.
She sees something. Branford sees something. My thought is that's great that the city got out of having to pay to run First Ontario Center. I think that when Sam Marula first proposed that idea a number of years, I mean, other people have proposed it. When he came up with an actual idea, I think it was a good idea.
Yeah.
And now that the city is out of having to run that, that's a good thing that it's now going to be out of the hands of taxpayers, that they don't have to deal with that. But if that's going to be a concert venue, surely a city this size has a market for the CEBL, the basketball league, or for the Bulldogs, or for some other team sports-wise.
Well, and I agree with everything you've said, but still puzzles me. If this was the long-term goal, let Andalar and Cadillac Fairview build a 5,000 or 6,000 seat arena in on the mountain, which is the only area that can grow for residential housing. And I say residential housing because downtown is going to be full of condo towers. But condo towers aren't full of families and little kids traditionally. And that growth would happen on the mountain. And you would have had your cake and eat it too, I think.
Well, if so, without getting too deep into tax stuff, because, you know, we're talking about other things, but last I checked, and I don't think it's changed in the last couple of years, last I checked, Lime Ridge Mall was the city's largest taxpayer. Lime Ridge Mall paid more taxes than any other building or company or anything else in the city. It would seem that keeping Lime Ridge Mall a viable functioning business would be a positive thing for the city. You want to make sure that place is still running and doesn't become like all those other malls that we've seen on YouTube videos all over the place that are empty now and decrepit and gone. And if you could put something there that would then allow for building around it and other things, housing and everything else, you're right. To me, it seems like it's something that how you want to do it and whether it was even feasible probably deserved, all I'm saying is deserved more attention than when Andlauer showed up at City Hall and got grilled and was basically told in no uncertain terms, we have no interest in listening to your idea. Our focus has to be downtown. We can only talk about downtown. We're only concerned about downtown. The mountain doesn't matter. And we had counselors saying the mountain doesn't matter. Counselor Esther Paul said it was very clear to her that the mountain was not an option because everything has to be downtown. And, you know, all these things over the years, Andlauer has now gone to Brantford, and you're right, he's paying for the kids' breakfast program, but my goodness, we have lost a guy who was an important part of this community.
Yeah. Now, one of the things I did hear, because I don't know all the details, is that the stadium may well have been on the other side of the link, and they were going to build a bridge over. There's a park over there that...
That was talked about once, but that was never the proposal. The proposal was that it was going to be, the rink was going to be attached to Lime Ridge Mall at the
north end
by the Fortinos.
Yep.
And then there was going to be housing, condos and other things on the property as well. There was going to be other residential. Like it's gone now. It doesn't really matter. The point here was just that I don't know that we're in a great position in this city to be chasing away philanthropic billionaires who run NHL teams and have the ear of politicians in Ottawa.
Yes.
It seems to me that was not the greatest move we could have ever done. That's all. We'll see. We'll see how that plays out. And we'll see if, you know where we're going to see this, Don, is if they end up in Brantford or if they stay in Brantford or if they end up in Burlington, whichever one, we'll see if there are other developments and federal programs that happen to pop up. Because I'll tell you one thing, in Ottawa, the guy who owns the NHL team in Ottawa, whether it's him or whether it's anybody else, I guarantee you can call up any politician, including the prime minister, and get them on the line. not every day, not every minute, but if Michael Andlauer calls Justin Trudeau's office and says, I'd like to chat with the Prime Minister, I'm the owner of the Ottawa Senators, I would bet you money he'll get a conversation.
There are some people who will think if he's going to call Justin Trudeau, he better do it soon as Prime Minister.
Well, there's that. But just in general, he as the owner of the Senators, he can have the ear of almost anybody in Ottawa, politician, bureaucrat, anybody. He's a huge deal in Ottawa.
Yep.
And how often he would use that leverage, I have no idea. I have no idea if he would ever use it. But boy, you would think that having a guy on your side who has that kind of Rolodex, essentially, or access, yeah, you would want that guy working for you. You would think.
I don't think people have Rolodex anymore, but I
get it. You know what I mean. You know what I mean.
I sure do.
I wanted to ask you about a guy who played some hockey here in Hamilton once upon a time. When the Hamilton Red Wings were still a thing, his dad owned the team, which at the time made you wonder whether, oh, you know, his dad owns the team, he's getting extra playing time, his brother's played here, you know. His name is Zach Hyman, who's turned out to be a pretty good NHL player. 52 goals as we speak, which I don't know that a human being alive saw that coming. I think he might have been seen by a lot of people as a solid 25 to 30 goal scorer on a decent team.
Who's he playing with?
Well, that's what I was just going to ask you. That's what I was just going to ask you, is that I think that there is no question in having seen him as a kid when he was here playing, and now there is no question about his work ethic. He's a really hardworking kid who's made himself, not a kid anymore, but he's made himself into an NHL player. He was not the guy who had all the talent. But is Zach Hyman a star player, or is he a really good wingman for star players? Because he played with Matthews and now he's playing with McDavid, and it's turned into a great career. I'm just, some people would say, you know, not everyone can play with those guys.
Not everyone can. And he's now playing with a guy who's kind of doing what Gretzky did many years ago when they said, well, you know, he gets 150 points, but he's not a goal scorer. And Gretzky went out the next year and got 92 goals and said, you know, chew on that for a little while. And a lot of people weren't giving McDavid enough credit for being a playmaker. So he set his mind to get 100 points as assists if he can this year.
Which he will.
And Zach Hyman, when your winger scores 52, you're going to be in on most of them. So is he a great player? I think you have to look at him as a great player because he's been able to adapt to the situation he was put in. There's a lot more guys that can't pick the game up, can't play at that level, no matter what opportunity they're given. And he's been given an opportunity, and he's excelled at it. And only really good, quasi-great players are capable of doing that. Like, if you remember, Semenko got in excess of 20.
I think he got 30 one year.
On more than one occasion, riding shotgun, and that's not what Hyman's doing, playing with Wayne Gretzky. You could have got 20 playing with Wayne Gretzky, I'm sure, even with your goaler pads on.
Yeah, but, well, unlikely, but yeah, he.
But Hyman can play the game, and he can play on both sides of the puck. Like, he's a pretty good defensive, responsible forward, which you need with McDavid, because not because McDavid won't back check, but sometimes it's a long way back. He is the best skater in the league, I think. But anyway, it's great. I don't know. Could he do that? Can he score 50 playing with anybody else in Edmonton? Perhaps not. But the fact is, he's doing it, given the opportunity, and did it.
See, the funny thing is, I think there's, when you ask this question, and it's been much discussion, there was a huge argument on YouTube and Twitter a week or so ago because somebody made a comment that was disparaging of, somewhat disparaging of Zach Hyman. And I think it's two different questions. I think, is he a great player? And is he a guy who is uniquely, is he a guy who has found a unique way to play with great players? I think those can be two different things, because I agree with you. I don't think that if he suddenly went to the Phoenix, Arizona Coyotes, I'll bet you all the money I have he's not scoring 52 goals. There's no way he's scoring 52 goals.
No, because if he played in that team, he'd have to figure out how to pass it to himself.
But it is difficult to play with great players. And we've seen it even on the Leafs. How many guys have the Leafs over the years tried to cycle through on Matthews' line to find someone who can play with Matthews? And half the time they look like they're lost.
Well, they had somebody. It was Zach Hyman.
That's funny. That's the point. But it is a unique skill to be able to play. And I saw a chart, someone posted it, of, and you've probably seen these before, it's the offensive zone broken into little pieces.
Yep. So,
and where Zach Hyman scored all of his goals. And like
in the crease.
45 of them were within 4 feet of the net. But as they used to say with Dave Andrechuk, I used to write this all the time when the Dave Andrechuk debate was going on about the Hall of Fame. They would always, one of the knocks against Dave Andrechuk was, yeah, but he scored so many goals on the power play. And my argument always was, well, aren't teams looking endlessly for guys who can score on the power play? Why are we dismissing this as an ability when everybody wants guys like that?
Talking about guys playing close to the net, Stan Jonathan won an Allen Cup with us in 1987. And he played with us the year before. We were sitting around having coffee after a game one night, and I said to him, the year you got 27 goals, Grapes had told me this, Don Cherry had told me this, Stan had the highest shooting percentage in the NHL. And I said, you've got a pretty good shot. And he says, do you know how I did it? I said, no. He says, half the goals I scored, I didn't shoot. I was in front of the net.
Yeah, they hit
it. And if you're there, they're going in off you.
Or you do the Phil Esposito, for those old enough to remember Phil Esposito, where the puck, it rebounds and you scoop it up and shovel it in. And again, though, let's use another example. I've heard a lot of debates online, on social media in the last number of years about who's the greater goal scorer, Alex Ovechkin or Wayne Gretzky, because, you know, Ovechkin is gunning for Gretzky's record. And one of the common arguments, I think mostly from people who weren't alive to see Gretzky play, is, well, look at the goalies in Gretzky's day. They could barely stand up, half of them. And my argument always was, well, then why did 75 guys not score as many goals as Gretzky?
Yeah.
If the goalies were that bad, why did everybody not do it?
Well, but then if you want to bring the technology aspect into it, look at the sticks they're using
for
now.
Sure.
And Gretzky was using a Northland.
For sure. But the point is, and it goes to the same thing with Zach Hyman, if it's so easy to do what he's doing, there should be five guys on every team that have 52 goals.
Yeah.
You just stand in front of the net and you shovel in a rebound. Boom, done, easy.
Yep.
I could do that. I mean, look, if Don, if it was seriously, you said I could do it. If it was seriously as easy as just planting yourself in front of the net and when there's a rebound, you shovel it in, or you put your stick on the ice and just wait for McDavid to bounce it in off your stick, that sounds incredibly easy. Turns out it's not as easy as it sounds.
It's a knack.
Yep.
Right? And tipping them in is a knack. And Jonathan would have got a bunch that way because he was a tremendous lacrosse player. So all you're doing is redirecting them. Is it a shot or is it not a shot? So that's an ability. And the ability to be able to position yourself when you know where the rebound's going to be. You can't have your back to the goaler all the time and shovel them in. Mm. You've got to push off and get yourself spun around so at least you can push it or shoot it in. Hyman deserves everything he's getting.
Yeah, I think there's two definitions that are getting conflated and confused in the debate about whether he's a great player or not. He's not a great player in the way that Austin Matthews or Connor McDavid are a great player. He's not.
Well, those are exciting superstars.
Well, but they're also the best players in the game at all kinds of different things. Yeah. I don't think that he is in that category. He's not a Nathan MacKinnon. He's not a Cale Makar. He's not. If you were just to talk about guys who have the most skill and can do the most number of things on the ice, he's probably not in the top 50 guys. But the one skill that he has is an ability to play with top players and finish, and that's a pretty good skill to have.
Especially when your next contract comes up.
That'll be interesting. That'll be interesting because I would love to know. I'd love to be in the room for that because you know exactly what the team is going to argue. It's exactly what we've just been debating. If we don't put you with Connor McDavid, we put you on the third line, you've got 15 goals. How valuable are you really? That's what'll be in the contract negotiations.
And my argument back, if I'm sitting at the Oilers or Hyman's thing, is, But you're not going to do that. You're going to leave me with McDavid.
Because I score 52 goals.
You don't have anybody else you can put there to score 52 goals right? but me.
And I don't know what that's worth now. I truly don't know what that's worth because a team wants to pay their top players, but it's going to be a huge argument is how top a player is he? Yeah. Because he can't do what he does without top players, but other guys who play with top players can't do what he does.
Yeah.
It's a fascinating situation.
So you can make the argument because of his ability to be able to do that, play with great players and score, say, an extra 20 goals.
Yep.
Let's say he's a 30-goal scorer in the National Hockey League, unless he plays with McDavid or Austin Matthews. But the point is you're going to play him, and you haven't got anybody else to go from 30 to 50-plus.
I don't know if he's a 25-goal scorer without those guys. I think his output probably doubles, but again, it sounds like I'm dumping on the guy. That's not it remotely.
I don't think you
That's
are.
Not it remotely. It's that he has this unique gift that so many other guys don't have to finish from superstars.
Yeah.
And there's so many guys that have been tried on those lines. The Oilers went looking forever for a guy to play with McDavid because they never could find the guy.
Well, quite bluntly, the Toronto Maple Leafs have not replaced Zach Hyman since he left.
They really have.
And there has been a long dance card of people that they've tried. Nyes is now on the third line with Willie Nylander.
Imagine if they had kept him. Now, I don't know who they would have had to get rid of because, you know, money is money and, you know, it's a salary cap. But imagine the Leafs lines if you have him there. Now, the other thing is he may not be doing what he's doing with Matthews because McDavid has specifically decided to become a setup guy this year as well as scoring. So who knows?
I mean, well, I don't think let me say this though. I don't think if Zach Hyman's playing with Austin Matthews this year, I don't think Zach Hyman gets 52 and Austin Matthews gets 65.
No, it's split up more.
They're just not going to be able to score that many goals, I don't think.
No.
Not very often you get a line and whatever plug, well, you got Mitch Marner with him, he's going to score 20. I don't think there's going to be a line in the league that's scoring 110 to 140 goals.
He is maybe the most interesting, and I don't even necessarily want to like talk in character or anything, although he's an interesting guy. He may be the most interesting player in the league because he doesn't look like he should be doing what he's doing, and yet the numbers are there.
I don't think the National Hockey League is that much different than the Dundas Real McCoys when you sit and have a coaches meeting and say, when you're looking at putting guys together, I don't think Ron Bernacki and I are the only guys saying, well, if we put those guys on the same line, our problem is there's only one puck.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
And you get so much talent, and if guys excel when they have the puck and there's only one of them, you got to figure something else out to make your team win.
The Scott Radley Show. Weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.
The Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening, and do not forget to subscribe to this podcast. It is free. You will never miss an episode. And also, be sure you rate us and review us. Whatever you think of us, we'll take it. Thanks for listening.